On this episode of The London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. D.G. Hart and Dr. Miles Smith IV about post-war liberalism and all sorts of topics related to it. So we cover all sorts of ideas and things like, what in the world does post-war liberalism mean? Does it have any real referent, or is it just a pejorative term? What's going on there? How does it maybe differ from things like Wilsonian idealism and other ideas? How do the events of the 60s and the 70s and others play into where we are today? So think about Vietnam, civil rights, sexual revolution, etc. How do those factors influence where we're at in our current moment? And much, much more. As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up on Twitter or Facebook or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now for the only analytic, Baptist, and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking. Well, I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of The London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak, and we are a podcast that is dedicated to serious thinking for a serious church. And one way we've tried to do that is to encourage and cultivate an intellectual culture of things like charity, curiosity, critical thinking, and cheerful confessionalism. We think we live in a time when the church needs better answers, and the answers that we need to find don't require like hot takes. They need to be thought through well and with in community and with friends who can challenge each other, because oftentimes we're much more open to our views being pushed and a little bit prodded when we have a friendship or a relationship with people. So we try to encourage those sort of things. And today I'm thrilled to introduce you all to Dr. D.G. Hart and Dr. Miles Smith. And Miles, I think you're the fourth, and I probably should have properly added that in my introduction. Anyway, I'm excited to talk to both of them about post-war liberalism and related things. I think this is a topic that seems to, at least on the internet, come up a whole lot more frequently over the last 5, 10, 15 years. It seems that I see it now every day, that every problem with America's political governance has its origin in some post-war liberal issue. So I'm excited to learn about what all that means and what all is fact or fiction or a little bit in between. So before we get started, Daryl, would you just give me like brief intro, who you are? Maybe give me a 30-second origin story of why you care about history or got into it.
Thanks. Good to be with you. I don't know if I'm a cheerful confessional. A confessional, I don't know. I'm probably more curmudgeonly, but curmudgeonliness makes me cheerful, whatever that says. So I was a film studies major as an undergrad in my misspent youth at Temple University. But I took a lot of courses in Shakespeare and also in some British history. And so that made me think, when one of my professors told me that only 4% of independent filmmakers, which is what I wanted to be, can support themselves, I said, well, maybe history's a backup. And then that didn't work out directly. I was hoping for tuition remission at Temple. They had too many white guys working, straight white guys working in the law library even then. So I went to Westminster Seminary and then became fascinated by church history and British history. The British history I was interested in was oftentimes reformational. And then I went to Harvard Divinity School and read J. Gresham Machen's Christianity and Liberalism for the first time, even though I'd gone to Westminster Seminary. And that's when I sort of shifted into U.S. Topics and subjects. So I teach all over the place, which Hillsdale allows us to do, but primarily American religion, American politics, American intellectual history.
Awesome. There's like six things you said that I'd like to make fun of.
Though that's fine.
It's fascascinating that, like
you
said,
my wife's away, I need to be made fun of.
Westminster's not requiring to read Machen? Like, how is that possible?
Well, back in the day, Westminster was for a long time the OPC seminary informally, and they would have assumed that students would have read it already coming in. But then they began to expand to include evangelicals like me, or fundamentalists even like me. And so I didn't have any awareness of Machen.
So you're a fundamentalist?
I was. I grew up there. Okay. Dispensationalist church. I won two Scofield Reference Bibles in various Vacation Bible School endeavors or whatever.
I know the Schofield reference, but I went to Liberty for my undergrad residentially, actually. So not like one of the online people. And Schofield was required for those Bibles were required for my courses.
Wow.
Miles, tell me a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, I had a pretty standard, I think, undergraduate experience at the College of Charleston and in Charleston. It was a great place, and it was history was kind of all around you. And so I probably shouldn't admit this, but I didn't think a lot about history living in perhaps the most historic city, definitely in the southern United States, if not the United States in general. And so I came at it because I was interested in Europe. I think I got interested in history because I was interested in Europe. And I was particularly interested in 19th century Europe and the rise of nationalism, the rise of liberalism, the rise of democracy on the European continent. So I sort of started out there and then came back to the United States when I studied abroad in Italy, because I realized what a rich, not just experience in undergrad I'd have, but I grew up in central North Carolina in kind of an older town called Salisbury. So there was just a lot of not just history, but religious history and sort of political history around me. My hometown had churches from the 1730s and a Confederate prison. So I sort of discovered the history of my own space after I had gone to do a semester abroad in Europe. And so I went to grad school to study the United States, but also to study Latin America and the intersections of nationalism and liberalism in the middle of the 19th century. So that was what I was going to do. And I kind of got a good talking to from my dissertation advisor, who's like, just make yourself an Americanist because you want work. And I said, work sounded pretty good. And so I became an Americanist. And so I teach mainly the 19th century classes here. I teach Jacksonian era and the Civil War and the Gilded Age. And every once in a while, I'll sneak sort of 19th century Latin America in. So that's basically what I do. I don't think I overlap with any of Daryl's classes. I don't think we don't teach any of the same things. So
that's awesome. Well, I think I could probably spend the whole episode just talking about you guys' background, but I want to know, I keep seeing this terminology, whether it's post-war liberalism or just like everything after World War II seems to have shifted with the American vision of politics and even the way people read older confessions. So like I see people will say, prior to World War II, they understood the Westminster Confession to teach X about the civil government to view the American Revolution and founding and particular way, why. But then after this World War II period era, things completely shifted. So I'm trying to just understand, I guess, first of all, what is this concept of post-war liberalism? Is it monolithic? Is there a way that I should understand it? Are there figures related to it? Those sort of things. I don't know who wants to jump on that first.
Well, I think I don't like the term post-war liberalism, because it assumes that there is a change in how people read liberalism that happens because of World War II. And my proposition would be that it's actually Warren Court liberalism. The way that the change in the interaction between civil order and religion, I think, is more of a product of the 1960s than it is the post-war era. Dwight Eisenhower, it's funny because he's the progenitor, he's sort of the origin of the Warren Court in a lot of ways. And yet, 1953 is a very different place than 1965 in the United States. So I don't really buy it as post-war. I don't know if the Second World War changes much in itself, because really there's a lot of things that are consistent with the 1950s in America that are happening in the 1980s, that are happening in the 1990s. So I don't really buy it as a monolith, and I'm not really sure what makes people think that there's a post-war liberalism other than the baby boom. If that's what people see as the source of post-war liberalism, okay, maybe. I don't know if the baby boom itself changes anything. So Daryl may have a lot of better takes than I do on that.
I mean, I guess I think of certain professors at Columbia, New York intellectuals more generally, talking about liberalism and liberal tradition in the 50s, which may speak to some of what you're asking about Jordan. And I do think part of what defines it maybe as different from what was before is the Cold War. And so you have this polarized world between the free world, the liberal world, and the totalitarian or communist world in the minds of a lot of people making arguments about the best societies, but also the United States' role in the world as the leader of the free world. And that, so yeah, I think there's a consensus about liberalism in a way in the 50s into the 60s that begins to unravel with civil rights movement, feminism, sexual revolution, the protests about Vietnam. And so there's some pushback during those decades, but the United States comes through it relatively okay. And the Cold War, I guess, dichotomy still persists into the Reagan era. And I think you would have Democrats and Republicans still identifying with a liberal order of some kind. I mean, they would emphasize different parts of it. More free market, more government subsidies for people who are marginal in society. But you know, there's a general defense of that. And you know what happens in the post-Cold War world from 1990 on, it seems to me that the United States becomes much more polarized. And but it's only, and I think maybe the seeds are planted for what we're seeing now with a number of thinkers, Christians among them, maybe especially among them, but then people on the left as well, talking about how pernicious liberalism is. So you have a variety of people talking about a post-liberal society, a post-liberal church. And I mean, I attribute a lot of that to Trump, reactions to Trump, you know, thinking of Patrick Deneen as an author who is very critical of the liberal tradition, even though he had been part of a defender of it in a way, a responsible defender of it, not in glowing terms. And then Christian nationalists, Protestants among them, coming along and making a case for why there needs to be a return to an older Protestant understanding of politics. That's really not pre-World War II, but much more pre-American Revolution, even. So that's how I come at that question. I do teach post-Cold War America here when I wear my 20th Century America hat. It's a great course to teach, although it's also more like journalism than it is history, because we still don't have historical perspective on, I guess we're beginning to have some on 9/11, now that it's 22 years away from us. But usually historians say you need about 35 years to get a decent sense of something. And so we're going to wait for a while to get a decent perspective on the election of 2016. But that's still a pretty important piece of the United States' recent history.
Can I jump in?
Go ahead, Miles.
So I think that when we talk about liberalism, it's compelling to me. We sort of, so many definitions are floating around. And so when you think about politics, I want to talk about sort of like the brass tacks of what is liberal politics. Because I think about a Supreme Court case very few people know about, Griswold v. Connecticut, which, Jordan, have you heard of that? I don't know kind of if it's in the ether or not. Griswold v. Connecticut, 1965. Where the Supreme Court rules, and this is interesting because this sounds like something that should have been happening in the 19th century, but it's happening in the 1960s. Griswold v. Connecticut is the case where the Supreme Court said that states couldn't prohibit married couples from using contraception. And so that's the case up until 1965. That sounds like some sort of antiquated era. So people hear that and they say, wait, the state could tell you in 1965, that you can't use contraception. They can tell married people that. That's in the United States. That's not That's not colonial Boston. That's not 14th century, you know, Italy. That's Connecticut. And so I think when we frame sort of like what is liberalism, oftentimes there's a tendency to almost say liberalism is whatever the current sort of kind of socio-sexual mores of my given year are. That's liberalism, and anything behind it is illiberal. And so I don't think of Connecticut in 1965 as being a theocratic place. And my guess is that listeners wouldn't either. And so is Connecticut before Griswold v. Connecticut theocratic? Is it illiberal? And if your answer is yes, then I guess liberalism starts in 1965. And so I think this is an important question to get at, because so many people, especially you think of a Baptist, right? You don't have en masse Baptist riots about Connecticut state government prohibiting this, right? You don't have sort of disestablishmentarian up in arms. So what does it actually mean to be a liberal? Seems an important question when we approach especially sexual stuff, because that's actually the core of this conversation, right? People are saying the world's gone crazy. They look at the post-Oberfeld world and they're saying, liberalism caused this, right? Well, I don't know. I think of Connecticut in the 1960s as a pretty liberal place as the broad West goes. So I think that's something to think about. What is it to be liberal in the context of the sexual revolution, which is so much of the energy behind this question to begin with?
Yeah, no, that does seem to be part of the energy behind it. This, we look at the state of things, we don't like the state of things. When was it better and different, and how do I get back there?
Can I just add to that Connecticut point too? William F. Buckley Jr., who's a graduate of Yale, which is in Connecticut, writes a book in 1950-51. God and Man at Yale, and he's very critical of Yale for abandoning religion, for abandoning defense of free markets, and in some ways abandoning a defense of the American founding. Now, William F. Buckley is an odd Roman Catholic, but he is a Roman Catholic. He's also the founder in many respects of the modern American conservative movement. And the Yaleys who responded to Buckley pretty much put him down as a Roman Catholic authoritarian type. So this goes to the liberal side of Connecticut establishment. Those people at Yale probably were comfortable with the restrictions on contraception that Roman Catholics would have also been very comfortable with. And so, you know, you have competing liberalism, competing restrictions, depending on whether you're a mainline Protestant or a Roman Catholic. But, I mean, Griswold does indicate a shift more generally among Protestant elites in the United States, and they begin to liberalize in that way, at least for a time. But as to back up what Miles was saying, they were pretty liberal back in the 50s as well, and saw Roman Catholics as authoritarian and as a threat to the United States.
Yeah, I think that, you know, you think about the 1950s, the way it's presented to a lot of people is that Dwight Eisenhower is the conservative against Adlai Stevenson in the 1952-1956 elections. What's interesting, those are before so many of the landmark cases on things like sexuality and women's rights. And so there's actually not a place where you can identify Dwight Eisenhower as meaningfully more socially conservative than Adlai Stevenson. And so Daryl's right, like you have almost a vision of competing liberalisms. And I think in some ways in the United States, that's what it is. It's two visions of liberalism going at each other. And every generation is kind of a new permutation of it.
Got it. So how do other events like Vietnam and then the civil rights and JFK and others, how does this, the events of the 60s and et cetera, accelerate some of these changes and impact some of them, make some of them?
Well, I mean, one way to answer that is civil rights legislation passed in 64 and then especially 65 and codified in all the sort of title 1989 and beyond legislation. Christopher Caldwell, a journalist of a kind, has written a book about the 60s and the way that civil rights legislation became part of the federal law and administrative apparatus, and the protection of certain aggrieved groups. And there are, I guess, lists. I know some people have talked about it, but I've never looked at that. But there are people who are designated, groups of people in the United States who are designated as deserving special protections. And that then creates a whole cottage industry of advocacy groups and law offices and even administrative bureaucracies at state, local, federal levels to support this. And I mean, that is, for me, reading Caldwell, Michael Lind is another guy who writes about this, whether he's a historian or not. But, you know, apart from the headlines, apart from the culture war pieces of the changes that are happening with, say, greater access to contraception and greater liberty and or greater sexual freedom, which is what a lot of people are advocating. And then, of course, fewer restrictions on blacks. Aside from whatever the headaches may be on the surface coming out of those changes, what's happening in courts, what's happening in law, what's happening in administration at different levels is really quite extraordinary. And I don't know that full story has been told as well as these two figures, Christopher Caldwell and Michael Lind, have been recently writing. And there are many others who have written about it as well, but those are the two authors that come to mind. And so it's if people today in the United States, and coming out of two or so years of lockdowns for public health, seeing what a governor in New Mexico is now doing with the Bill of Rights, if people think the United States is teetering on some kind of a illiberal set of laws or policies, and that government is taking away my freedoms, these access to that kind of power, I think, has been going on for a while. That's part of what I'm trying to say, and it's been happening since the 60s. And it wasn't because the radicals who were going to college and engaged in the campus protests eventually got jobs, and then they did it in the 1990s, say, the march through the institutions. The march was happening well before that in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, thanks to just the way bureaucracy works.
Yeah, I agree with everything Daryl said. I think some of this idea that we're in a particularly post-liberal moment, it's fed by people who desperately want to believe we're in a particularly sensational moment when it comes to government power. I mean, I think about the presence I remember reading, Daryl, you may have had to read this book too, David Kennedy's book on the 50s and the work of David Halberstam to kind of on the mid-century. And they're almost, the point of it is to sort of say, is almost, I think, inferentially like, hey, the 50s weren't perfect. There was all this stuff that was going on with, you know, obviously African Americans didn't have rights, and, you know, a lot of urban poor were kind of left behind the prosperity. What's interesting is how much you can hear as sort of like a Trumpist sort of American carnage dialectic in a little bit of those works. But of course, now the idea would almost be to baptize the 50s as the height of liberal success, right? Of course, you would want to include the 60s because that's where the sort of aggregate of civil rights legislation is actuated and whatnot. But what's happening now is I think a lot of this is really just because, I don't want to get too reductionist, but it's partisan, right? Right? A certain group of people sort of loses power, and so, okay, now the 50s are bad. But in the 80s, there was kind of like conservatives tended to sort of baptize the 50s because they were good. That was the nuclear family. And now there's this sort of proposition that the nuclear family actually has failed. And so it seems to be driven not so much even by the historiography. Daryl's done a good job laying it out. But so much of the question of liberalism is driven not by actual books about liberalism or questions about liberalism or even a definition of what liberalism is. It's driven by a sort of a rhetorical construction of what liberalism is vis-a-vis certain people not being able to actuate sort of a certain given reef of political or of policies or something like that.
Is this making sense, Jordan? I mean,
yes.
With the kind of, because we have all been part of email exchanges. I'm not sure if we should let the listeners in, pull back the curtain. But, you know, and I was struggling, I think Miles was somewhat too, with where this phrasing was coming from. So I am just curious if, and obviously you're in charge, you're driving this recording, so you can say, well, wait a minute. But I am curious whether it's kind of tracking in some way with what you're hearing.
I think part of the main question for me, I mean, I'm not the historian of this era, so I don't know all the answers, and that's part of the reason that I'm trying to figure it out and asking you guys, because you guys know these periods better than I do. It seems that there is just a common thread among more recent literature that I've seen to where it paints this sort of like dividing line that happens post-World War II, to where America used to be like this. It used to be a Christian nation. It used to be, you know, have blue laws. It used to have all the, like a sort of like a moral conscience of some sort. And now we've lost that. And that's because of how we shifted to think about virtually everything, whether that's church relation to the politics or whatever.
Yeah. And so much of this, I think, is based on chronological ignorance by lay people. I'm not trying to say that only scholars have this right, but a lot of the stuff that people think went wrong in era X actually had nothing to do with era X. So like blue laws is something that's identified with the post-war era. Jordan, you're from North Carolina.
Yeah. Well, no, I'm not, but I've been here.
Yeah. You've lived here a long time. Well, guess what? In the 1980s, there's a lot of stuff that was still closed on Sundays. You can remember the pharmacists, they had everything roped off except for the drugs. I remember that in my home county. All that stuff went away in like 1994, right? So like, I mean,
not with the state store system in Pennsylvania, fella.
Well, of course, like, both our home states have these alcohol monopolies, and if you know what the ABC store is. So, right, is the alcohol monopoly that Virginia, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania have, is that pre-liberal? I don't know. But it's a good question, because does this mean that liberalism began when Newt Gingrich came to power? So I think that's actually an important question, because for sort of both sides, the type of person who wants to baptize the given moment and the type of person who wants to have everything be a golden age, there's this shifting chronology of what is actually when liberal begins and when it doesn't begin. And you kind of go around this I don't want to say like a merry-go-round, but again and again and again, the dates are shifted. And so the definition of liberalism is hard enough to pin down. The definition of when liberalism messes everything up seems even harder. And I think that's purposeful, right? Because if your point is we have to go back to some idealized X, and I'm the guy purveying literature about idealized X, then you sort of have a high ground established that is unassailable.
Yeah. So I guess part of the impetus is just as I look at, I'm more of a theologian and philosopher than I'm a historian. I mean, I love history, but I want to become better equipped at it. But over the last 10 years, post-Trump, there has been a significant increase in theologian or pastors becoming more interested in, like, well, I want to change my vision of politics, and then it ends up subsuming all sorts of other theological doctrines. And so we've got a lot of our listeners here who are listening, and they're thinking, I see this, like, I hear it all the time. Pastors who are telling me they have church members who are getting, you know, radicalized by various visions of, like, well, this is the golden era. We go back to the 18th, 19th century, whatever it is. And we had this vision of Christian engagement, and now we have something totally different. And if you want to get that back, you've got to go over here to Moscow or wherever the place is. And so I'm trying.
That would be Idaho, not Russia, right?
Okay. That's right. Well, yeah. Well, it could be either, I guess, theoretically.
Well, I'm going to say something that I think this is evangelical brain. The evangelicals always have this sort of next level, more energy. It doesn't matter where they come down, what their political theology is. So you can find the most hard and fast spirituality of the church guy who's really convinced that the spirituality of the church is going to save the church. And you can find another guy who's really convinced that theocracy is going to save the church. I mean, my own disposition is sort of, a sort of mainline blasé adiaphora on all this stuff. And what's funny is it actually keeps me from having to really get political theology right. By not baptizing one or the other, it actually allows me to say, I don't know. We're going to go to church. We're going to do the prayer for the whole state. That's what Anglicans do. That's our Christian nationalist thing we do every week. You know, we pray for Joe Biden as a part of our Christian nationalism. You know, we sing the fourth verse of My Country, 'Tis of Thee. And we do that no matter who's president. You do that no matter who's president. So what's interesting to me is that so much of this, I think, proves to me that evangelicalism has always been sociopolitical. It's not theological to begin with. And so that completely explains why, guess what? Trump got elected and everyone rethought their political theology. Who gives a deuce whether he got elected? Why should that make you rethink anything? So that's my mean, cranky Anglican take on it.
Hey, I thought I was the curmudgeon.
Yeah.
2016 is a great time to write books to make money. So there you go. There's my
Yeah, cranky yeah. Take. No, you're right. You're right. I think that we've, I mean, evangelicalism, as much of it's a sociopolitical identity, is a commercial one too. And you're right. It's really helpful to write books. And listen, as long as Trump's in political life, we're going to hear more of these books about how so-and-so learned that hit Christian, that people learned that politicians were hypocrites in 2016. Like, you didn't know that before, champ? Come on. So,
all right. Richard Nixon just never was.
Yeah.
Part of the, but, I mean, to push back a little bit, Miles. So what, I agree with what you were saying, by the way, that it's adiaphora. But then you have some fairly strong political views, I think. I mean, we've had conversations. So what is your perspective on making those, or the basis for your making those judgments?
I think that ultimately,
I mean, I don't think it has to be theology, but I do think a lot of Christians think I've got to go to the Bible, or I've got to have it come from some kind of theological understanding, because that's the most important part of my life.
I would expose myself. I'm not a very good biblicist. Like, I please don't get your politics from the Bible. That'll be the worst place to get it from. Because there's this whole thing called literally 2,000 years of Western history, that's just as good in a lot of ways. So a lot of people say, well, that sounds like you don't believe in the inerrancy of Scripture. No, that's not what I said. I just said I don't think that the Bible is the best place for a programmatic understanding of politics. If it is for you, great. If it's a programmatic understanding for your anti-politic, great. I'm just not a biblicist, so I don't think I need the Bible to teach me politics.
But I think what's important, perhaps, about that position is that you have to sort of identify, come to terms with 2,000 years of history, or at least 250 years, and figure out what the better political arrangements may or may not be. And if you like the founding, which I do, and that kind of liberal political tradition, which it is liberal, especially given the history of the West before that. So that means that you have to sort through what the different political positions are, rather than, which seems to be the approach of a lot of Christians for a while, not just now, of, okay, I'm a kind of conservative, whatever this, and now I'm going to find that in the Bible.
Right.
And that's going to justify my position, instead of saying, no, you know, politics comes first, sorry to the Bible, but that does come first, seems to me, when adjudicating political problems. When you want to adjudicate human nature or sin or God and what God requires, those are theological judgments. But, and those have, you know, they are, if, you know, Madison said, if men were angels, so we're getting right into human nature and what do we need government to do and what do we want to keep government from doing, because we know that men are not angels. So we put all sorts of checks and balances in the constitutional order. So it's not as if, you know, the Bible doesn't speak in indirect ways to these questions. But for me, as somebody who's kind of a libertarian, but in the sense of a American founding small government Jeffersonian type, I think that Jefferson was worried about standing armies. I mean, a lot of the founders were. They were worried about a foreign policy that would take the United States into foreign wars, especially European wars. And where do we find ourselves for the last 70 years? We're all in up to there. So what is that going to do to our liberties, the kind of liberties that were secured at the time of the founding? And I mean, that for me is, you know, gets into foreign policy and America first and American hegemony. And I think a world order is important. And I think having good countries try to uphold a world order is also important. It's part of the way that the world has worked for more than 2,000 years. So I don't want to be naive about that. Someone's going to do it. So the United States, if it's going to pull back, better be smart about it. But still, our place in the world is out of sync, I think, with our founding. And our place in the world also came at a time in the post-war sense, Jordan, that you've started us talking about. I mean, I do think that the American government and security state apparatus, both to protect the United States, but then also to protect American interests around the world, was part and parcel of giving greater rights and liberties to aggrieved groups so that they could participate in this system to make America as unified as possible to fight the Cold War and beyond. You know, you don't want people opting out of that system. So I'm not saying it was cynical. I think there were legitimate reasons for doing that as well. But a lot of those changes in legal and civil rights, I think the Cold War and America's involvement in the Cold War makes sense of some of those changes in order to, again, shore up America's measure of social order, coherence, and peace at the home front. And, you know, now that we're not fighting the Cold War, but we are kind of fighting the Cold War still. I mean, that's still a kind of pattern that we have, whether it be Russia, whether it be Islam, political Islam, whether it be China. The United States learned how to think about itself and the world and the rest of the world in a kind of Cold War pattern. And that does still, I think, inform at least federal officials, who are the ones who are supposed to be worried about foreign policy.
I think I agree with a lot of what Daryl said. I'm probably more Hamiltonian in that I like Eastern commercial cities dispositionally, or now Texas.
Right. I mean,
And so I don't think I
can't really do the agrarian thing.
Yeah. So I don't think I'm a very good agrarian for a variety of reasons. I think that when I think about the way, especially Christians talk about politics, American empire, whatnot, I wonder if empire is an inevitability. And so sort of to what Daryl said, is somebody's got to keep order worldwide. Might as well be the American one, but gosh, do we have to do it the way we do it? And I think about the way that Christians, particularly self-identified evangelicals, talk about American government. I think the Ukraine war is a good example. I think I'm dispositionally on the side of the Ukraine. I believe in national self-determination. That's good. But what seems to me is there's an idea that an evangelical worldview leads you to baptize one of these as sort of dispositionally God's people, not really God's people, but God's definitely on their side, and one of them is not. And the delineation for that is that one of them is at least approaching market democratic liberalism more than the other.
Well, there are more Baptists in Ukraine than Russia, too.
And that's actually true, right? And you think about the amount of adoptions that are done by evangelicals from the Ukraine. So I think in my mind, why don't we just say, I give the nod to the group that is trying to uphold national self-determination. Why does there have to be why do you have to Bible that answer? Why on earth do you have to Bible that?
So, Miles, I mean, I'm with you. I'm not a biblicist. And maybe you'd be like, Jordan, you're a biblicist because of X,
you're
Y, and Z.
Jordan, so you're a biblicist. No, that's not actually true.
I think a lot of people would say, yeah, I hear what you're saying. But there's still a sense of, they want to say there are theological principles or things that can apply across the board. So the Bible says, do not murder. I can take that. And yeah, maybe that's a natural law principle. You'd say, well, I don't need the Bible for that. I can get that elsewhere. But people would still say, well, I can, it's much clearer and easier for me to go to the Bible and get some of these sort of like natural law principles and then project that onto my society and require it to do that. And they'd say, that's a good thing. And so in some ways, it's at least epistemologically useful to have the Bible helping me out and working in this way here.
So what's the controlling principle in keeping that from becoming theonomy?
I have no idea.
Yeah. So I think that's, I think when I think about the way that a sort of biblicism turns into a rhetorical theocratic dispositions, I don't think everybody does that. I think why? Because ultimately they kind of trust liberalism as a control on their reading of the Bible. And that's not necessarily wrong. But you're not really being a biblicist anymore, are we? We're being American liberals. And that's not a bad thing. I like liberalism. I'm a liberal. Lord Macaulay is a hero of mine. Francois Guizot is a hero of mine. People don't know who they are, but they're heroes of mine. I think I'm a liberal. What I don't think is that I'm a 20th century biblicist who reads liberalism a specific way. And so I think in as much as that's become the sort of Christian definition of liberalism, that's where the tension is. And for at least someone like me who likes Daniel Moynihan, he's a hero of mine. So I think that's where the tension is, right?
Okay. So tell me, how much does like Wilsonian idealism play into these downstream impacts that we start seeing later on in the 50s, 60s, 70s? Mm-hmm.
I'm reading Barry Hankins' book right now. Daryl probably has a better. I'm changing a little bit on what I think about Wilson because of this book. It's a very good book. I think you know him, Daryl.
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
I'm changing a little bit.
I mean, I locate Wilson in the progressive tradition, and I think. Progressives were theologically generally modernists, and that meant that they had bought into modernist ideas of adapting Christianity to the modern world, but also that God was working his ways through the advancement of Western society, Western civilization. And I think for whatever reason, World War I didn't put a dent in that. The Great Depression and World War II did put a dent in that. So in the history of theology, at least among mainline Protestants, you go into a period after, well, in the late 30s into the 50s of New Orthodoxy and the appeal of Reinhold Niebuhr, less so Karl Barth, although Karl Barth does make it onto the cover of Time magazine in 1962, I think. But that's a more restrained view. I mean, I just reading a piece with my class in American religion yesterday about Reinhold Niebuhr being President Obama's favorite theologian. There are all those kinds of references. So, I mean, I think that Niebuhr and that tradition kind of put a bit of a pin in the bubble of Wilson's idealism. I still think there's plenty of idealism. You listen to President Biden at times talking about the war in Ukraine. There's a lot of Wilsonian idealism still, a lot of promotion of democracy still. So it's still there, but there have been people in the State Department, people in so-called swamp or whatever, who are more realist as well. And that would be what Niebuhr represents. When it comes to domestic policies, though, I mean, you know, the constant attack on Wilson now is that he was an outright racist, and he made the federal government even more racist. So I don't think there are many domestic issues that people run to Wilson for. Sorry to end a sentence in a preposition. And, you know, I think for domestic policies, I do think that New Deal liberalism is different from Wilsonian in some ways. And the response to the crisis of depression is really important for getting a welfare state going. And I don't know that, you know, I think we'd associate that much more with FDR than with Wilson. And I still think that's clearly around. We're having debates now about, especially after COVID, and the kind of restrictions on work and the government bailouts of people who could not work. And then on top of that, debates about immigration and where those people can get jobs or not. A lot of those issues are still very much with us. And I don't know that anyone's necessarily following the playbook of New Deal Democrats at that point either. But I don't think that Wilson, aside from foreign policy idealism, is as much a presence.
Well, I want to know, this is the last thing I need to know from you guys before I close up shop. Where can people go to read all the works that you guys are writing and doing? Because I know a lot of our listeners are probably interested in these sort of topics and would like to, number one, read your stuff, and number two, have good recommendations of where to go.
Yeah, I blog a lot at Avantes. I write for National Review semi-regularly. And so that's kind of my stuff is more looking at the 19th century. I'm really more interested in where the shift is away from, especially in education. I've been looking at colleges a lot. I've been poring over college catalogs from 1820 to 1870 and learning a lot. But yeah, I'm kind of doing that stuff at Ad Fontes. I'll have a book out with Davenant here in the next 6 months, hopefully. So
awesome.
So yeah.
Yeah, I used to blog a lot at something called Old Life, and I've been trying to write a little bit more there. But I also co-edit a journal, a newsletter called the Nicotine Theological Journal, which comes out online. But I think for the books I've written, I think of American Catholic, which is about the Roman Catholic origins of the conservative movement in post World War II America. I've written a spiritual biography in the same series that Barry Hankin's book on Wilson is in, but it's on Ben Franklin, a guy who I really admire, among the founders, on so many levels. And then also I've written a book about H.L. Mencken, a journalist, literary critic, libertarian, whose political instincts I really trust oftentimes, even though he lives in a different era. So if people wanted to look for those books, they would at least get a read on some of the people I interact with and follow.
Awesome. Well, I'm going to have you both on back, or even do specific episodes with both you guys, because I want to have more time with you. But I appreciate you guys doing this. This was a lot of fun. I recommend you all to check out their work, to support them, to follow along with what they do. And thanks, everybody, for listening to the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet. And we'll talk to you guys soon.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.